Hey everyone, welcome to the CLG podcast where we break down the information asymmetry on all things blockchains, oracles, and smart contracts. Today I have an episode with Daniel from Traction Capital. We plan to talk a little bit about just some of the recent market trends and some of the broader ecosystem trends with the different tech being developed. We're in a bit of a weird state of the market right now, and I thought it'd be an interesting conversation to have with Daniel. We were on Twitter Spaces a little while ago, and I think this is almost like a follow-up conversation to that. So, welcome, Daniel. How are you?
I'm doing well, Zach. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Do you want to provide a little bit of background of who you are and who Abstraction Capital is?
Absolutely. So, I'm founder of Abstraction Capital. Abstraction Capital is a quantitative investment fund where we also use fundamental research for asset selection. Currently managing personal and friends and family portfolio. In terms of myself, I am an ex-aerospace engineer who got into the space in late 2017. I've been investing in the space, I'd say since mid 2018. And after DeFi summer, left my job to focus on investing and trading in crypto full time. So that was late 2020, early 2021.
Okay, very cool. Yeah, you come from a very different background for me, but it's always interesting to hear about the different backgrounds people come from. I think to kick things off, it'd be interesting to just talk a little bit about where we are in the market. I think obviously the Bitcoin ETFs launched, that I think that changed the dynamic of the market a little bit, just this institutional constant flow from the Bitcoin ETFs. And obviously we have the halving coming up pretty shortly, I think less than a week at this point, potentially an ETH ETF. Cautiously optimistic, but we'll see. But I'm curious on your thoughts on what the ramifications have been from the Bitcoin ETF and kind of where you see things going. To me, and let me know if you disagree, it just feels like we're in a weird time in the market with Bitcoins and meme coins, but then altcoins are kind of almost like forgotten about a little bit at this point.
Yeah, definitely. So I think there's been a lot of discussion about how this cycle is different with respect to Bitcoin making an all-time high before the halving, which has never happened before. So there's all these theories about, is this a left-translated cycle? Is this a shorter cycle? Has it already topped up? Obviously, there's kind of macro uncertainty and FUD coming up again. And I think a lot of people are confused. Personally, I actually see the situation. I actually feel like I have more clarity about the situation. To me, the ETF is probably the most significant development that's happened in the crypto space. And I don't think that that's going to cause the market to peak earlier. What we do know about markets is that they are reflexive, meaning that the higher prices go, the more that triggers new buyers to actually come in, right? Price is the signal itself. And I like to think about markets really at in a kind of like with a momentum framework, right? When I think reflexivity, I think momentum. And to me, the Bitcoin ETF has created, hundreds of millions, so, per day, typically between around 500 million, sometimes as high as $1 billion of inflows per day. And so to me, right, if you were to detonate an atomic bomb in the middle of the ocean versus just a couple sticks of dynamite, the atomic bomb is going to create waves that travel further, right? The larger the initial impulse, the further the waves are going to go. So to me, based on the way I understand how markets move, I think the initial impulse from the ETF is actually going to create a market cycle that goes, longer or to generally the maximum duration in the context of a 4-year cycle. And I think it's going to go higher, right? I don't think this is going to cause the market to peak out sooner. So because we have gone up so fast, right, I think the market just needs time to kind of cool down. And that's what we're seeing right now. I mean, Bitcoin still, it retested 60K today. It was defended. It's still not below 60K. Obviously, all coins have gotten decimated, but Bitcoin looks absolutely fantastic, right? And I know I'll get to your question about altcoins soon, but with respect to the halving as well in 3 days, right? The halving is also an incredibly bullish event for Bitcoin. People, always question, does it matter? It doesn't matter less with each market cycle, and potentially its impact on price might diminish as the market cap of Bitcoin gets higher. But every halving, I mean, the halving is incredibly important, right? Because currently there's an entire class of miners that are just barely breaking profitable right now, and in roughly 3 days, when the production cost of Bitcoin doubles, there's an entire class of miners, right, where it now costs them more electricity to make a Bitcoin than the price of Bitcoin, right? So they turn off. So all of those selling flows stop instantaneously, right? We might chop around for a little as kind of there's some game theory around what the best thing to do as a miner or as a Bitcoin whale around the halving is, because theoretically, you want to keep prices lower to kill out all of the weak miners. But once they're all dead and those selling flows stop, right, the, I guess, compression of Bitcoin supply is around 4% monthly. And, with ETF flows theoretically picking up again, BlackRock hasn't even gone over around one-tenth of their total marketing budget for the Bitcoin ETF. I think price is going to pick, rapidly appreciate. So I'm very bullish right now. I think, we could kind of chop around here for the next couple months. A lot of people have made a lot of money already this year and might want to take summer vacations and stuff. So I think there is some seasonality. There's a seasonality component to that. To get to your second question regarding kind of the dispersion across the alt market, I agree, but I disagree a little, because if you look at a lot of the kind of like the alternative L1s, I'm talking like a Sui, a Say, a Injective, an Aptos, whether you look at some of the top games like an Echelon Prime, a lot of the DPIN stuff or AI stuff, a lot of altcoins have gone up significantly, like 3, 4, 5x, even as high as like a 9 or 10x in some cases. And that mainly happened between November and January, maybe going into February a little. After all those assets price, were priced up late February, going into March a little, that's when we saw the AI and meme coin craze. So I think we had a little bit of like a mini market cycle since mid-October, when actually Chainlink was the first asset to run. It actually ran a day before Bitcoin ran, which is interesting. But really, I'd say since mid-October to maybe end of March, early April, we saw kind of, the rotations occur, meme coins being the last thing to get the rotation. I think they went up the most by far and they got most of the hype. But I do think that there were altcoins that outperformed really, really well, just, when stacked up against the meme coins, not quite as much.
Yeah, it's definitely been bizarre for me to see. Just it feels like this cycle, or at least this portion of the cycle, it's just been compressed almost, where every month it's something completely different. Like, do you think we're just destined to keep repeating the same L1 rotation cycles? Like, we saw a little bit of that, but it was pretty limited, like you mentioned, to specific sectors. But do you think, like, when the next leg up happens, we're just going to repeat that process continuously, or is there some specific trend that you think will persist more over the longer term?
Yeah, I think, it's interesting now, because unless a coin has a strong narrative, I don't think it substantially outperforms Bitcoin. And I think an easy way to see this is if you chart a coin against its BTC pair, kind of does the structure of the chart look like its USD pair, right? I think that, if you look at something like an Avalanche, for instance, or like a Polkadot, they've kind of been trading in a range against Bitcoin. Maybe, Avalanche, not quite, it's not a little better. But if you look at something like Solana, right, that's outperformed significantly against Bitcoin. So I think some L1s are going to do very well. Others, I think, will just kind of trade as Bitcoin beta based on a factor of their market cap. But I think it is clear to me, the L1s that have, significant developer activity, retail interest via something like meme coins, those are the ones that are actually going to significantly outperform. In terms of this cycle, what I've seen, trying to ignore just, low cap coins that have gotten repriced, AI coins have performed extremely well. Obviously, meme coins, right? I think at this stage in the cycle, meme coins have completely outperformed prior expectations. So I think that that's a trend that's going to continue as well. And then there's been some kind of idiosyncratic offshoot coins that have done well, but to me, those two are the strongest narratives so well in my so far in my opinion.
Talked a little bit about this before recording, but it seems like there's more development momentum happening behind Bitcoin itself, where historically Bitcoin's always been just Bitcoin, the asset itself. And now we see ordinals, we see runes coming up, we see these chains, these L2s, so to speak, being built on Bitcoin itself. Do you see Bitcoin having its own ecosystem akin to what we see with the Ethereum ecosystem of its own chains or side chains and projects being built upon there and those getting momentum just based on the performance of Bitcoin? Or do you think that's just like a short-term distraction almost?
I think in the long term, I don't see those things as a significant component of Bitcoin, but in the short term, they definitely are gaining a ton of momentum. And I think this is you always have to differentiate between short term, based on this cycle, and actually like the long term steady state kind of operation or state of these applications. I just don't see how these chain or L chains, which really right now are side chains, can compete with the Ethereum modular stack. Bitcoin is just so far behind that there's no way they can catch up, right? In any type of network effects based business or sector or with respect to these applications, they're just so far behind, and Bitcoin is not optimized for computation at all. I just don't see it as a long-term, like, I guess, I don't see Bitcoin L2s as capturing, significant market share in the long term versus the Ethereum modular stack. Now, in the short term for this cycle, I think they're absolutely going to perform well. And, we've already seen a hint of that with ordinals. Typically, when you see things outperform very early in the cycle, that's signal that there's interest there and that it's going to continue to do well. And there are, there's a whole cohort of OG Bitcoiners that want to do something with their Bitcoin, and they might feel more comfortable doing it over there than in the Ethereum ecosystem, right? Everything comes down to incentives at the end of the day. And if there's an incentive, if there's an economic incentive for people to create that because they think they have a user base, then it will be created. Do I think it'll capture long-term market share, a significant amount of long-term market share? I do not.
Kind of lean the same way as you. Maybe I'm a little bit more optimistic, or maybe hopeful is the better word, that there could be an ecosystem built on Bitcoin with side chains and L2s. But my feeling is it's almost a symptom of a broader trend that we're seeing, that everyone is expanding out and looking how they can launch their own chain. Like, we've seen just an insane amount of different Ethereum L2s launch over the past year, and all these different chain ecosystems taking different approaches, whether they're parachains or whether they're subnets or whether they're all collecting on Solana itself. It feels like there's just a proliferation of multiple different chains and chain stacks being built. Do you think that's over time there'll be more of a concentration to a few chain ecosystems? Do you think there'll be specific clusters? Like, how do you kind of see the multi-chain ecosystem playing out? Is it inevitable that we're just going to keep becoming more and more fragmented across all these different chain environments?
So I think in terms of I like to kind of think of chains as like in terms of the base chains themselves as security layers or execution layers. Obviously there's some other components like something like a Celestia or something like data availability, but just at the core, right? I think that all the chains are going to either be kind of turned into execution environments where fees are super low and they're competing with other execution environments, or kind of security environments like Ethereum, which are kind of these hubs that where execution environments pay for security. So that's kind of like the L2 to L1 relationship. To kind of get back to your question, I do think just like pretty much everything else in life, there'll be a power law distribution that defines kind of the TVL and usage across chains. I think there will likely be, maybe 3 to 7 large winners, maybe even less, and then they're that are kind of like the main security hubs, right? It, with respect to execution layers, right? I think that I don't think there's going to be a ton of kind of generalized L2s. I do think kind of the end game for an application is if you, let's say you launch on something like a Solana or an Arbitrum, right, where you have composability with other apps, you know that there's users there, you can get distribution, you become successful, right? You kind of solve the chicken egg problem, you start to generate fees, right? You grow. Once that occurs, it's actually under your best interest to go launch your own app chain where you control your own block space and can capture your own MEV, right? And fully optimize everything for your specific application. So I think the winning apps end up launching as their own app chains or L3s or whatever, right? Which then those all roll back up to the whatever, base security, chain there is, like an Ethereum. So I think the kind of the end state here is there's a couple security hubs. There are, maybe a couple dozen, generalized execution layers, right? And then there's going to be tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands standalone applications that are winners. Maybe, I don't know the exact number, maybe less than that, that because they're successful, they move off their generalized execution layer onto their own app chain. But I do think, yeah, that there will be consolidation for kind of everything below the apps, in my opinion.
To expand like that your example a little bit, what I could see happening, and hasn't really happened yet, but I do think that like dApps will launch on chains that already have network effects and liquidity to benefit from that ecosystem effect. Once they get the volume and usage, they splinter out or move out into their own L2 or their own standalone chain. And so they can control the revenue flow more directly to their own gas token and control the MEV. But my sense is once they spin out to their own chain and they have their own network effects and the users follow the application, then there's a large incentive to then basically make that app chain more of a generalized chain at that point and start accepting other applications to deploy into that chain. And then once those applications start to grow, then they splinter out into their own chains and the cycle can kind of continuously repeat after that. So my sense is it's almost like an accelerant, or it's like a replicating factor where the more app chains there are that become more generalized, attract more apps, which then become app chains and then generalize out themselves. So it seems like it's just going to be like self-replicating continuously over time. I'm not sure if you see the same perspective here.
No, that's an incredibly interesting point. I haven't heard of that before, but that absolutely makes sense, right? And considering the open source nature of a decentralized application, right? You could see competition for something that works coming in incredibly quickly. And if someone makes something better, then right, they're going to suck those users away. So that's a great point where it's kind of this naturally evolving thing. And over time, you'll have these kind of clusters that form. But as you kind of get out further from the center, let's just say, like, just to make it easy, right? Ethereum is the main security hub. There aren't any other L1s, right? Then you have the generalized L2s, and then I guess the largest winning applications that become generalized, people build there, and kind of the further away you get from the center, kind of the more rapid things change, and the more things continue to evolve over time. But yeah, I think in terms of the main, security layers, I think that that's going to be much, much harder to disrupt.
Yeah, and now that we have all these roll-up as a service providers, I think there's like five or six bigger relevant ones. Like if people can launch a chain in like a minute, then it'll be just exponentially easier for devs to start thinking about spinning out their application to their own chain environment. And my feeling is that within this environment where we just have, we have the security hubs, we have the generalized L2s, and then we have like the more app chain specific but could become generalized chains expanding outwards. There's effectively like two winners in that environment. Like the security settlement hub itself, if you can become Ethereum or become a competitor to Ethereum at the security level with the asset itself being the crypto economic security for the whole chain cluster, that is a very valuable position to be in. And I think the other position that's valuable to be in is the interoperability and connectivity. Because the more and more the ecosystem gets more and more fragmented, then the value of being able to connect all those chains together just becomes immense, because my sense is that over time, like right now, when users go and they use a blockchain, they're thinking about, I'm going to go use Arbitrum and I'm going to use the Arbitrum applications, or I'm going to go to Optimism and use the Optimism applications. But I think in the long term, people will focus more on dApps and they won't really care what chain environments they're on, or those dApps will just exist across multiple chain environments and they just go to whatever chain environment is convenient. So I think the interoperability almost starts to break down the moats between different chains, and block space becomes more fungible between different environments, especially if they're all secured by the same underlying settlement security layer itself. So my sense is over time, things will shift more and more towards not just cross-chain, but like chain abstraction of being able to pay gas costs with the stablecoins or the tokens you already have. You don't actually need the gas tokens. Being able to execute transactions on any other chain from any other chain. Like once you're in that environment, the settlement layer almost disappears. It's still very relevant, but the interoperability is almost like the glue between those different chain environments. And so I think like the war for settlement, I think Ethereum is like basically won at this point. There's other chain environments doing data availability, which really is complementary. But then like the interoperability, I don't think there's like a clear winner in the interoperability sphere just yet. Everyone has their different approach and their different angle towards approaching it. Do you think there's like any other categories that I'm missing here? Because I really feel like it's settlement and interoperability, and then that just fuels all the apps, and the apps are more of a concentrated bet for people and which one they want to actually bet on. But interoperability and settlement seems like that's almost a winner take all type environment.
I definitely agree, right? And I think the one area that you might be able to add is priority gas fees. And I think in the long, like let's say 5 to 10 years, at least my thesis, something I've grown about is it seems like block space or trust on chain trust minimized computation is highly deflationary, right? We're just going to keep getting more and more execution environments that are more and more efficient. New types of L2s, maybe specifically ZKs that can compress theoretically exponentially more number of transactions into a single proof. So it seems like block space, the cost of it is trending, effectively towards zero or, like whatever, like let's say like the cost of cloud compute, right? It's going to get super, super cheap. With respect to priority gas fees, maybe, there are specific execution layers that can sustainably capture value from that. I do think MEV. So, right, in a world where block space where the, effectively gets compressed to zero, how are any of these execution layers or apps sustainable? It's through MEV, right? And especially for financial transactions, there's always going to be a significant amount of MEV, or at least enough that can be captured to sustain everything, because right, having your transaction go in first versus someone else's is extremely, extremely valuable, right? So whether it's capturing the MEV and spinning it back to the users, or having something like specific transaction ordering that you're paying for, I think that that'll be another place where value is captured. But to kind of go back to the question a little, I think everything is going to be tokenized and everything is going to be used as money. So I think, there's something people talk about value capture and like having, a token being having a money-like feature to it. To me, right, the more your token, right, I would define monetary premium as an additional multiple to the value of your protocol that exists, because people actually have to buy your token, right? And if you look at something like the US dollar or, the petrodollar, effectively what has allowed the US to continually print money for the last couple of decades is because the entire world had to pay for oil in US dollars, right? And there's some research out of Chicago. I've referenced this in some of my work called the inefficient market hypothesis. The buying of an asset can increase the market cap for anywhere between 5 to 500 times, however much money was or how much however much asset was purchased, right? So, right, buying causes the market cap to go up a lot more than the inefficient or the efficient market hypothesis would actually predict, right? And once again, this is consistent with kind of the reflexive theory of markets. So having people need to buy your token to do whatever they need to do, I think that is right? The most valuable thing possible. And so if there's going to be all these different security hubs with, all these connected L2s and L3s and app chains, right? Whatever the base token that has to be purchased to pay for everything, like the most, that's going to be the most valuable thing. And so if there is a single dominant interoperability solution, right, the surface area that's going to have with, the entire universe of potential applications, L2s, L3s, and L1s, that is going to have the highest monetary premium, in my opinion. And also, if, they are, let's say, if there are winner take all dynamics, then they could potentially, set fees at a higher level than something that could just easily be forked and copied. So, in terms of like the way my mental model of everything, I think that, right, if there is a winning interoperability solution, I do, based off, the theory that block space is going to get compressed towards zero, I think that that's probably going to be the largest protocol by market cap, in the crypto universe.
Tend to agree, but I think that it's almost like the bear case for gas tokens, because with chains today, if you want to use a chain, you basically need a surplus of that gas token, and usually people have more surplus than what they actually need to make transactions on that chain. But if we get to a state where there's complete abstraction, where you can pay on demand with any asset like stablecoins for the gas costs, and then in the background it's converted to the gas token, paid out to the validators, and then validators take profits or do whatever they want with that those payments, then I almost feel like the property of being a gas token doesn't actually accrue a whole lot of value to that token itself. And I think the whole industry, I mean, if you look at market valuation, L1s always get like a premium over other layers of the infrastructure or applications. And I think people's mental model is that if you're a gas token, then people need to hoard that token, and then that's universally good. But I don't remember the exact EIP, but there's a upgrade to Ethereum coming where other addresses can sponsor your gas costs, and you can pay that relayer effectively in anything with any token you already have. And there'll be some network effects with the most liquid tokens that these relayers will be willing to accept. But I think there'll be a whole marketplace or a whole layer of the stack that's just transaction relaying, which is like it's effectively just abstraction layer. Pay for anything with any asset that you already have, and then it flows down to the chains. And so I think the environments, like the protocols that really benefits, protocol tokens that benefit from that, is ones like Ethereum, where the bet is really that Ether becomes more of a currency, where markets are denominated in Ether versus just purely being the gas token. And then, like you mentioned, the interoperability, where if you have one token and you can use it across all these different environments, and the portion of the revenue collected for all these cross-chain interactions accrue back down to the token itself. Like that, I think that's ultimately why people are so interested in like the universal gas token thesis, because it's like becomes, in one perspective, the one currency that you need to transact across the whole chain ecosystem. And the other perspective, users can pay with whatever currency they want. And then on the back end, it gets converted back to that interoperability token and paid out to service providers and accrues value to that interoperability token itself. So I think there's kind of these two prongs, but either one of them ultimately almost negates the value of gas tokens if it doesn't have a monetary premium that's derived more from like a currency market type use case versus purely gas tokens itself. But I don't think a lot of people have that perspective. Otherwise, I don't think gas tokens and L1 chains would be valued at such a high premium as they are.
Well, even if if you can pay in anything, right, in the background, that's still going to get converted to the native gas token to execute the transaction. Like at the end of the day, you need to use ETH to, like, that is the final, that, like, for the final payment, it does need to be an ETH, right? So if you pay in, let's say, some type of apps token, right, that's sold. So theoretically, the market cap of that app would go down because that was sold, and then you're purchasing ETH then to execute the transaction. So I still do, like, there is the gas tokens of the chain still, right? They capture that monetary premium, but I guess with gas costs getting compressed to the lower bound, eventually, the amount of monetary premium that they'll capture from that in the absence of, let's say, priority fees is going to continue to go down over time. But once again, I still strongly agree that for the interoperability solutions, if there is a winning one, then that is going to be the highest in demand token.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking of like environments like Solana where you can make, I mean, if you have $100 worth of Solana, I mean, gas cost wise, if you're an average user, that can last you a lifetime. Effectively, that there's no reason to get a surplus versus if you only ever make transaction worth $20 worth of gas, that's the maximum amount of pressure you'll put on that token versus people who feel that they need to get a surplus of it ultimately. But I think it really depends on what the gas cost of that chain environment is, and if people still want to hold the native token itself beyond just the usage of gas itself. So I guess I see that it would be kind of like a compression factor a little bit. Like gas will still be a currency that needs to be paid for in that chain's native asset, but if you know a billion users come on chain and they don't actually need to hold the gas token, they just hold stable coins and whatnot, that doesn't seem like a great situation for that chain to be in, even if at the end of the day it has to be converted. I think at that point you would just want to be the dominant token, like every market denominated in that gas token, because then you have other token sinks beyond just gas itself. So I don't think it's like a death situation for the L1s, but I do think that's like a perspective that when everything's abstracted and nobody needs to hold surplus, that kind of diminishes the value ultimately, especially as users don't think about, am I like using an app on Ethereum or am I using an app on Solana? They're just using a like a Web3 app and they don't really care what that settlement layer is. So I think there just has to be other forms of value capture. And I think MEV will be probably the dominant factor for a lot of chains, especially when their execution costs are so, they're so extremely low.
Yeah, no, definitely agree with that, right? Like, I think Solana is a great example because it's actually been capturing a lot of fees from priority fees of people just, market buying meme coins. But yeah, definitely in a steady state scenario, right? 0.00025 cent fees is not enough to cover the long term inflation costs of the chain, which I think are currently like somewhere around 7-8% and are supposed to decay down to like 2-3% over the next like 6-7 years. But yeah, it would have to be there would have to be a lot of transactions on the chain to cover the inflation.
Yeah, in terms of like these different chain ecosystems, I assume you're more aligned or like you are looking more towards like the modularity. I think you're really bullish on that. Do you think there's a path forward for the integrated Solana type approach?
Definitely, right. I think that ultimately it's going to come down to, right, everything's about network effects, and Solana has established that. And if so, if there's one killer application built on that chain, then right, that could be enough to sustain it. And I do think, right, they have a ton of upgrades coming. Fire Dancer, a lot of their parallel transaction stuff is leaking into the Ethereum ecosystem. There's people building SVM, Ethereum L2s. So I do think, it's tough to say like in 10 years if it'll be around, but in the short term, it has, Solana has product market fit, even just as like a meme coin casino. And so it's hard to see it going away in the long run, like let's say 5, 10 years from now. Could something like Solana, which has to, pay for its own security, could it compete with the modular stack? I find that harder to believe because, for instance, what happens when, L2s, first of all, what happens when L2s, right, become fully permissionless? What happens when the technology, advances and, their fees drop from, 1 cent to down to 0.01 or from 0.01 to 0.02. I mean, there's a point where the fees are on kind of the same order of magnitude with Solana's fees, but you're also getting the security of Ethereum. And so, right, it's does Solana keep lowering fees to compete with the L2s, but then, now you're generating less fees to pay for security, right? There's that constant tug of war. Which is why I just think, right, the kind of the modular stack, the L1, dealing with security, L2s dealing with execution, I think that those are more sustainable in the long run. Obviously, it's going to take, many years for that to play out. That's definitely how I see it. But yeah, in the short run, I don't see Solana going away. All right, I don't see these all L1s going away. If there's one killer application on them, then they're probably here to stay.
think that's, I mean, it's a little bit, it's inherently uncertain, like which way the industry is going to go. I do think that there's room for both types of models. I think they're very complementary, as you mentioned. Each ecosystem kind of learns from each other, and then we can create an ecosystem that really takes the best of both worlds. But I think that's also why I'm very comfy with Chainlink, in that it doesn't really matter ultimately what chain wins, because every chain is still going to need market data or any kind of data. It's still going to need off-chain compute, and it's still going to need this interoperability between different chain environments. And I think, at least from what I've seen historically, there hasn't really been a competitor that touches all three of those different prongs. Like, there's specific competitors within the data sphere of things, and competitors within cross-chain, and a little bit of in computation and like automation in those spheres. But in terms of like the unified platform of providing all the services that chain needs, I've historically not seen a competitor that really gets close to touching all those prongs, except maybe something like Eigenlayer. Coinbase is also more of a centralized implementation, but they're trying to build out their own platform with Base and their Coinbase wallet and their whole stack of services. So I guess I'm curious, do you see anyone else who kind of competes on that same level of Chainlink?
I don't see a true competitor. Obviously, with Eigenlayer, one of the main use cases capable with the technology is creating something like a price feed that is backed by Ethereum security. I do think it's a lot more difficult to make an Oracle network than right like. Then it's not just a price feed, right? And Chainlink's kind of proven that out. Also they're what 7 years behind. So yeah, once again, like maybe their technology is capable of doing some of the things that Chainlink does, but the network effect that Chainlink's already established is so big that I just Eigenlayer would have to be 5 to 10 times better. Or less expensive to compete. And Chainlink already has, highly competitive pricing for everything. So, it's definitely something to maybe keep an eye on. But with respect to the services that Chainlink provides, I truly don't see a competitor in the market.
Yeah, and I think it's a lot of protocols are focused on what can be done within the Web3 DeFi sphere, which is obviously what everyone's focused on with public chains. And then there's this whole parallel world of TradFi development on private chains, and sometimes happening on public chains like BlackRock and their tokenized Buildle fund. But I think that's like a whole sphere of things that people don't necessarily focus a lot on. And Chainlink is like one of those projects that's able to put its feet into both of those spheres, ultimately to connect both those different spheres together into one unified ecosystem. And I think that's one angle that I don't think a lot of other projects are taking. They're either focused on like the DeFi degen casino space that is kind of DeFi today, and like the TradFi institutional capital. And I don't think there's a whole lot of protocols focused on how can we hot swap or inject in the trillions in TradFi liquidity and traditional assets, and put that into the same infrastructure that's been powering a DeFi casino over time. I'm optimistic that people come around to it, but I also don't think it necessarily really matters if they do, given that it's going to be inevitable anyways. But
You're absolutely right, right? Like there's so much, right? All the attention, as you probably know, hanging out on crypto Twitter all day, it's all on the degen casino, right? And obviously there's some VC pump and dump tokens as well, but there's so much attention on just the degen casino that I feel like truly nearly the entire market is missing the forest from the trees. Right. Even if just 1% of the capital from the traditional financial system flows into the crypto universe, right? That's going to inject multiples to the market caps of the protocols that take in that liquidity, right? Like crypto is a drop in a bucket compared to the size of the capital markets. And if right it all it's going to take is once again it doesn't matter if whether the market understands this or not, because the second that, let's say theoretically, Chainlink CCIP goes live and people are looking at the transaction count numbers, the fees, maybe the new TVLs or TVS, right? The second that there's a bunch of nine zeros behind those numbers, or maybe 10 to 12 zeros, the market will then figure it out pretty quick. And so yeah, I do think the RWA narrative has picked up a little with BlackRock announcing the BUIDL, their BUIDL project. But this is just the tip. It's the tip of the tip of the iceberg. And so yeah, whoever has the most access to the most liquidity is going to win, right? It's going to have the strongest network effect. And you can show me any other bridge solution, any other price feed, it doesn't matter, because Chainlink is the only one that's partnered with Swift, which essentially controls the entire global financial system with their messaging network.
Yeah, I mean, I've always seen DeFi as it's effectively just a case study for what an on-chain finance ecosystem will look like. And everything that is happening right now is really just stress testing infrastructure, playing out different models, different infrastructures, seeing what sticks. And I think protocols that have clear network effects and proven adoption within the DeFi sphere, like Chainlink, and is already working with the institutions, really just means they're setting themselves up. So when institutions really do start to step in and tokenize real amounts of assets, like they're going to go for the infrastructure that, like the infrastructure partners that they're already working with and has already proven to work within DeFi. So, like across the board, there's certain sectors that generate revenue within DeFi. Usually it's the exchanges or the perps or like the things that actually facilitate the speculation that's happening. And a lot of the infrastructure doesn't always see a lot of those revenue streams today. But that all changes when real institutional capital starts to step in. So my feeling is like the Bitcoin ETF was obviously monumental for the whole industry, just in terms of legitimizing Bitcoin and crypto as an asset class and the liquidity it introduces. But I feel like BlackRock tokenizing a fund on the public Ethereum blockchain, that's almost as big of a big deal as that is the largest asset manager in the world proving to everyone else, yes, you can actually tokenize assets on a public blockchain. And they're not going to stop there. Like, they're not going to stop with one tokenized fund. They're going to see how far they can go with it. And that starts to be a forcing function for everyone else to start to jump in at the same time. So it seems like the trajectory is pretty clear. I think there'll be like this parallel world of the DeFi casino will continue to operate because speculation casinos is a use case. But then the real actual dominant use case of tokenizing all these assets and using public chains and interoperability protocols like CCIP as the infrastructure, like that's what's going to attract the actual amount of capital that's coming in. So I really see everything happening in the short term is just noise for the most part. And things take a little bit longer on the TradFi side because they're just gigantic entities that have to comply with these regulations that have clearly not caught up, at least in the US and in most places. But when they do catch up, it's just going to be an extreme acceleration. I don't think a lot of people who are just focused on DeFi casino speculation are really going to see what's coming or really understand what's happening once it does happen. Because people say like RWA and they think, oh, it's like, a sub $5 million market cap shitcoin that says they do RWAs. But that's not really what we're talking about here. This is more like BlackRock and JP Morgan tokenizing assets. And I think those smaller RWA projects, they are riding the narrative wave, but I don't think they're really going to be super relevant. Like there'll be a few relevant ones like Securitize, who's already working with BlackRock. But a lot of the RWA projects are really just kind of riding the wave. They're not the core infrastructure.
Exactly. And let's go back to value capture for a second, right? And incentives. So, we've already talked about all, the most successful apps breaking off and making their own chain so they can capture their own MEV, and potentially priority fees. You really think that that the largest institutions in the world, the BlackRocks, the JP Morgans, et cetera, are just going to go, build everything on open infrastructure and pay the native validators and give them all the MEV? No, they're going to create their own permission chains where they control their own assets, their own fees, their own MEV, et cetera. And they're going to use Chainlink CCIP or theoretically some other interoperability protocol to interact with the other chains, right? And when you think about what DeFi is, right, it's really you're taking some aspect of the current financial system, and you're replicating it with code, right? So, in terms of let's say exchanging assets or trying or getting a loan from a highly diversified pool of collateral, you can have your assets sitting on, let's say, BlackRock can have their assets on BlackRock chain, and then they can interact with kind of the public markets on Ethereum or Solana or some other chain for specific use cases. So also with the Biddle tokenized treasury thing on the BlackRock zone on Ethereum, right? How does there's going to value capture now. Really, the only fees that Ethereum captures from that is just the gas fees of moving tokens around, right? And as we've discussed, gas fees are getting compressed towards zero. So the extent that public chains are going to capture value from these TradFi institutions, it's only with respect to gas fees when they do choose to interact in the public markets, in the on-chain markets. And gas fees are they're going down. They're gonna go a lot lower than they currently are, 2, 4, 6, 10 years in the future. So once again, the interoperability standard for, because everyone has their own incentive, everyone's going to be building their own environment for their own assets that they tokenize. Really, the interoperability standard is the one that captures the most value, right? So, if there's the $687 trillion in the traditional financial system, the extent that that amount of money is paying fees to the current on-chain ecosystems, it's just with respect to gas. Chainlink, though, obviously capture or CCIP, or once again, some other solution that could theoretically do this, captures value from any time any asset needs to move to a different chain or anytime anyone needs to interact with some application on a different chain. So the universe of, those potential interactions, at least in my eyes, is much larger than the universe of, potential actions that could take place on any single individualized L1.
Yeah, I think you put it really well. I mean, the same way every app's going to have their own chain, every bank's going to have their own chain, but they're still going to need to trade with each other because not everyone's going to come to that bank chain. And they still want to be able to trade in environments where retail exists in the public chain environment. But those markets, at least the way they currently exist and they're likely going to exist, they're not going to be trading markets against gas tokens. So you're not going to get that monetary premium from being, every NFT is trading against ETH. But all these tokenized real-world assets are not really going to be traded against ETH. They're going to be traded against the dominant currency, which is the dollar, which is stable coins, which have really, I just think of it as another type of tokenized asset that's already proven product market fit to the tune of what, like 150 billion or so at this point. So it seems inevitable that every bank will have their own chain, and then they'll need interoperability to do DVP trades across these different chain environments, while the bridge can effectively take a portion of the value going over every transaction. And like that's ultimately, I think, like the bull case for Chainlink and for interoperability protocols in general. It's not like, how can we monetize people rotating across chains, chasing meme coins and chasing airdrops? Like that's can be profitable in the short term, but in the long term, it's the TradFi tokenized asset flow. And that even like that thinking even flows down to how the interoperability protocol is designed and how it expands the different chains. Like some bridges will say, they're on 100 million. They're on like 100 chains or something. And then you look at the chains and they're all kind of long tail ghost chains that TradFi is never going to touch. But if you can prioritize the main public chains and then prioritize the private bank chains and connect those two, even if that's like a more concentrated number of chains, if you get the relevant chains, that's way more important than scaling out to 1,000 long tail chains that aren't relevant as much. So it even comes down to like how that interoperability protocol is designed. And I don't think any other protocol is being designed with that approach in mind, like CCIP is.
It goes even further beyond that, right? Because anytime an asset, some type of real world asset moves between chains, the data that defines that asset needs to get updated, right? And so, not only does Chainlink have an advantage with respect to what you just talked about, but they also do price feeds, right? They do proof of reserves. Theoretically, with Deco, they could do I identity information, right? And these are all, or Deco for, privacy and identity, right? So theoretically, these are all things that are necessary prerequisites for some type of, RWA token to move between chains. And their platform can solve all of that without introducing any new type of security risk because it's all, secured by the same consensus mechanism that, right? So that even further cements kind of Chainlink's network effects.
Yeah, definitely. And it's why it kind of makes me laugh when people ask, like, what role does Chainlink have to play with RWAs? And it's, well, the answer is RWAs don't work without the Chainlink platform. You need all the market data and all the identity and POR data. You need the cross chain, and you need both, because if you move a token to another chain and you don't keep the data with it, just bridge a token that's basically meaningless to everyone in that destination chain. You really need both in one platform. And if you are able to pitch all the public chains and get it adopted there, and then you do that in parallel with all the TradFi chains, like when the legal walls come down and institutions are more easily able to interact with public chain environments, if they're already on the same standard, then connecting with each other is one in one. You just plug them together. Everyone's already connected to the same standard. So that's kind of why I feel like nobody is taking the same approach as Chainlink, or nobody's really a competitor on the same level, because nobody offers what a tokenized asset actually requires. And these requirements come from not working with DeFi projects, but working with banks, and banks saying, this is what I need for a tokenized asset, and then Chainlink building that infrastructure. And so, if you're like a competing bridge and you're not talking to institutions and you're not actually actively working with them, you're just going to end up prioritizing the wrong things. You're going to be scaling out and seeing how can we bridge these meme coins. And then you're not thinking about all the other edge cases and all the other conditions of, oh, institutions, when they tokenize assets, there has to be KYC, AML conditions. There has to be certain policies attached to where tokens can be bridged and how much can be bridged and who can actually hold the tokens. If your bridge doesn't support any of that metadata, they just can't use that bridge. But if you have CCIP and the risk management network, which handles all those conditions and all those policies, like you have those features and functionalities in there day one. It doesn't compare with anyone else.
Yeah, agreed, right? So, I think obviously crypto's an attention game, and in the short run, the protocols and the applications and projects that optimize for pumping their token in the short term are probably going to be more successful at that. But obviously they're kind of completely ruling themselves out of the conversation of capturing part of the pie. That's going to exist in the long term. And the size of that pie, as we've talked about, is, it's not billions, it's not trillions, it's tens to hundreds of trillions. Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, one other thing I wanted to touch upon before we wrap up. It's like on the topic of RWAs, like I mentioned, I think stablecoins are just such an obvious product market fit of tokenized dollars on chain. And like there's some recent, not rulings, but some, I think it's like proposed bills about how stablecoins are regulated in the US. And one of the conditions is basically what they call algorithmic stablecoins, or anything not backed by cash and cash equivalents effectively becomes illegal, which can wrap up a whole bunch of like crypto collateralized stablecoins. But like people's attention, from what I've seen, like in terms of new things actually being built in the industry, Eigenlayer and restaking is like one segment of things, and that's more on the infrastructure level. And the other is Athena and stablecoins, on how do we develop a new stablecoin that's not backed by dollars and cash equivalents, but also not really entirely backed by crypto either, but rather a mixture of liquid staking ether plus a short position on a purpose exchange, kind of combined into one asset. I mean, Athena's grown just absolutely monumental. It's almost related to RWAs and tokenized assets, except it's like a crypto version of it. I'm curious what your thoughts on there. It seems like it's a little bit of like a controversial protocol, just given the way it's designed.
Yeah, I think it's controversial because it's currently paying out extremely high APYs, and people hear, or see algorithmic stablecoin, and they immediately think Terra Luna, which probably brings up a lot of bad memories for a lot of people. But right, Terra Luna was algorithmically designed to go to zero as Luna was sold to pay out those deposits. Whereas Athena is a completely different mechanism, right? So it's backed by essentially the funding rates in crypto perps markets are tethered around 0.01, 0.01 per 8 hours. So that's around 9.5, 10% annualized. And as more people want to trade crypto with leverage, those funding rates go up, right? So that the perpetual, or so that the futures product, can be tied to the actual underlying price of the asset, right? As they further diverge, right? The incentive is to actually begin to short the future to bring it closer back to the spot price. And so what Athena does is it's actually shorting Ethereum and capturing that funding rate. And also it's taking Ethereum and it's staking it as well. So it's getting, whatever the Ethereum staking rate is, and it's paying out all of that to users. So I actually think this is a super cool product. The largest risk actually, obviously, like if, let's say the bull market ends and everything starts to get bearish, and now everyone's, shorting Ethereum and the funding rate drops negative, then you could actually have negative APY theoretically on the Ethereum stablecoin or the Athena stablecoin. If you look historically, the amount of time that funding rates stay negative is actually extremely, extremely low. And so the way they've designed everything would make it so that, right, any type of like, extended negative funding rate risk, that's actually very small. The larger risk is that, right, Athena is partnered with all the centralized exchanges where they're getting those funding payments from, right? So they're shorting on, Binance and Bybit and, whatever. Hopefully, in the future, some on-chain perpetual futures markets. But really, to me, the largest risk is those centralized entities not being able to make those payments theoretically. So, there's obviously a risk with everything, but Athena doesn't have this like algorithmic go to zero type mode. Obviously, in a bearish environment, you'd want to be more careful holding it because the funding rate risk does increase. And also, right, when everything's going down, if centralized exchanges are doing anything sketchy, if they were lending out, if they were lending out money or, doing more with customer deposits that they shouldn't have been, something like FTX, and they can't make those payments, then obviously, your Athena stablecoin doesn't exist. So different set of risks than Luna. I think less risky. And during a bull market, I think, right, it's a great way where you can kind of capture that, people speculating on the market. And in at least a bull market, that APY is sustainable, right? It's not here's 20% and it's arbitrarily set. It's dynamic based upon however much risk people are taking in the market, based, wherever those funding rates line up. So I think it's a super cool product. I think they're calling it a synthetic dollar instead of a stablecoin. I personally like to think of it, it's almost like just an instrument to kind of, in a sense, hedge your positions because you're capturing that negative funding rate and you're holding stable, you're holding something tied to a dollar so it's flat. So I think really cool product, interesting product. Definitely do some research yourself if you plan on holding it to understand all the risks, but it, in my opinion, it's not a Luna situation.
Yeah, Athena's a funny one. I agree. It's definitely not Terra Luna. It doesn't have a death spiral risk because it is actually backed by something. Terra was backed technically by the ability to print Luna, but that doesn't, obviously, that didn't work out very well. I think the goal is very interesting. I mean, it's similar to DAI in a sense that you can have a stable coin that's more scalable and doesn't depend on the banking system since everything's based on centralized exchanges and natively staked Ether or really LSTs. But I think, like, in terms of the funding rate risk, that one's more one where I'm not entirely sure because all the historical data about perp funding rates is from a time when Athena didn't exist. And now we have Athena. And if Athena scales up to 10 billion, 20 billion, 30 billion, I mean, ideally, they want to scale up Athena to 100 billion. And is there enough market liquidity? Is there enough activity to scale up Athena that large? And if things quickly reverse, can they close out those trades without impacting the peg? Like, that's. To me, it's almost like an unknown unknown type situation. My preference always been just, tried and true cash and cash equivalent stable coins like USDC. But I think there is a place for something that's a stable coin but doesn't actually depend on the banking system. I probably wouldn't even call it a synthetic dollar. I think stable coin, it's a dangerous thing to call it that. I think it's more like a tokenized basis trade. It's more like a fund, really, a tokenized fund, which a little bit like a money market if it was tokenized and took on more risk. But yeah, I guess to me, there's like so much unknown unknowns, like the risk on the centralized exchanges, but also it's basically changing the way the perp markets work. So I feel like historical data isn't as relevant. But I guess I don't want it to be one of those things where it looks like it's working in a bull market and then a bear market happens and then we realize it doesn't actually work as well as we thought.
Yeah, no, that's such a great point, right? Because if the thing gets super large now, right, you're there's game theory around, okay, how do we potentially make, manipulate the funding rate to make money, right? So that's a really great point. And if I don't want to go too far over, so let me know if I'm going long, but this concept of stable in the first place is it's kind of a meme, right? Like the US dollar at a 2% inflation rate loses half its value in 35 years, right? Like the dollar isn't stable. Nothing's stable. Like the world is it's dynamic, right? Everything's constantly changing. To me, the one thing that is stable is how much energy is, all right, how much energy does it cost for a human to live per day or per year, right? You can annualize it. Let's just say, how much energy does it take for a human to live per day? So to me, that is the one, that is like the stable, like the thing that everything should be measured off of. In a sense, right, as we as humans are able to generate electricity for cheaper, right, the cost of let's say staying alive per day, that decreases. It's interesting, Bitcoin is tied to the electrical cost, right? And so to me, the stable coin is actually Bitcoin, right? And I think in the long run, Bitcoin's going to appreciate to some very high, number, million and a half, something like that. And it's just going to stay there. And I think everything's going to be denominated in Bitcoin, right? And as humans advance in, with respect to our ability to create energy, whether it's with more nuclear reactors, like I could see micronuclear reactors powering Bitcoin miners in the future. And then, let's say eventually fusion power, as humans, the cost of energy is going to keep going down over time as the technologies get better, which means it becomes more and more efficient to mine Bitcoin, it being tied to the amount to the cost to generate electricity, right? Right. Bitcoin, in a sense, that's the stable coin, right? It's the largest, the most decentralized. It's tied to the physical world. So as you know, there's conservation laws in the physical world. There's no form of social consensus. It's just, you have this distributed miner network, and that's it'd be really, really hard to kill that, right? So to me, Bitcoin is the stable coin. It's just appreciating so much against the US dollar that it doesn't look like a stable coin.
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective. I mean, stability is it's really relative. Bitcoin's made at this stage optimizing for stable supply. Fiat tries to be stable in terms of value, though obviously, as you noted, over time it basically built to inflate itself away over time. My sense is that like over the long term, I think Bitcoin will actually become like a boring asset to hold, in the sense that if things do become increasingly denominated in Bitcoin, it becomes more of this global currency, then it naturally becomes more price stable relative to what you can buy with it over time. So I think Bitcoin almost become like a, almost as boomer as gold itself. Obviously
Completely agree.
superior
Yeah.
in basically every way, but like I think it like that's the end state of Bitcoin is Bitcoin's not going to be volatile as it is now or what how it has been years ago. Like Bitcoin is becoming less and less volatile as time goes on. It's still extremely volatile compared to many other assets in the world, but I think it's really optimizing for longevity and it's stable supply. And so I think it's nice to live in a world where we can have the optionality of choosing between those different assets. But I, long term bet, I don't think I'd want to bet on fiat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in a funny way, when if Bitcoin wins, that just means it ultimately becomes the most boring. I think it has a long way to go before that happens, but that just tying this all back to together to the beginning, like that's why the BlackRock ETF is so bullish, because it's now legitimized, and now that the rabbit's out of the hat, and Bitcoin exists as an option for people, or at least the second that thing breaks 100K. Every single institutional asset manager that's been telling themselves and their clients that it'd be fiduciarily irresponsible to hold Bitcoin, right? Second it breaks 100K, every single person in the world or in America is going to be going to their asset manager and saying, "Hey, like my friend just made all this money off Bitcoin." Like it's going to quickly become fiduciarily irresponsible not to allocate a little Bitcoin to your client's portfolio. And that's going to be a major shift. And when it happens, right, that's when the fun really begins. And that's where we're going to start to see some government interaction, action against Bitcoin, right? Because it's at the end of the day, they need their current, like, they still control the militaries, they have a monopoly on violence. They need to make sure their currency is backed and fully funded. Their bought, their treasuries, all that stuff. So Bitcoin, though, as an alternative, I think is going to force governments to be more responsible. And hopefully, in the long run, once it does appreciate a lot, then it's kind of, it's going to be like true, like the truest, purest form of collateral or stored value. And that means it's stable and it's kind of boring.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see a state where governments accumulate and hold reserves of Bitcoin in the same way they do with gold. It feels like, I mean, that's ultimately kind of an end state use case. Bitcoin is like the ultimate reserve collateral asset for everything. So I'm definitely aligned there. Just to wrap things up, I appreciate you coming on the podcast and talking about these topics. You definitely have very deep knowledge in all these different topics. Is there anything you want to plug or areas where people can find you?
Maybe just by Twitter, it's at underscore dshap dshap. Feel free to direct message me if you have any questions. I'd be happy to talk.
All right, perfect. Yeah, definitely give Daniel a follow. He has very great insights on the market and Chainlink as well. But thank you all for listening and have a good one.